Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now is MSNBC host Dylan Radigan, who was on just before Chris Matthews every day, the 4 o'clock slot for a progressive talk on cable TV. He has a new book, the title of which I will withhold for just a minute. Dylan Radigan, welcome to WNYC.
It is a pleasure.
So one thing that makes you interesting is that you came over to MSNBC from the business channel CNBC, where you hosted Fast Money. And before that, you were the global managing editor for corporate finance, of all things, at Bloomberg News, correct?
All true. It was what my career was in New York City for 15 years was finance and financial journalism.
So in that context, it's surprising that you would write a book called Greedy Bastards, How We Can Stop Corporate Communists, Banksters, rhymes with gangsters, and Other Vampires from Sucking America Dry.
I can see the confusion. I can see why that would be confusing.
Did you have a life-changing epiphany at some point along the line?
I did. I was naive in 2008 and also in 2009. I was of the belief from the day that I began working in the financial world at the age of 22 that while it was remarkably competitive and remarkably audacious and outrageous in many ways, that at its core was a noble aspiration, which was to seek to provide a way to figure out the best place to put money with ideas, and that the future is generally driven by matching money and ideas to solve problems, creates jobs. And I felt that at least as absurd as the periphery of Wall Street is and all the rest of it, that at its core there was a noble nugget.
Did you work in finance before you worked in journalism?
No. My first job was at the age of 22 working for Bloomberg and worked as a print reporter for the Newswire for 4 years and then sort of came up through that at a time when there was a lot of growth, and I happened to have a good feel for the needs of that division.
Up to global managing editor for corporate finance at Bloomberg News. But you call yourself a capitalist,
right? I am a capitalist. I'm one of the last remaining capitalists, as far as I can tell.
What does that mean to you?
What it means to me is that you have to understand the definition of capital in order to understand how to define capitalism. And I think where we've lost ourselves is we have defined capitalism through all sorts of lenses of money, basically, and having money and pursuing money, and that's what capitalism is, which, in fact, that is not what capitalism is. Capitalism is a very simple thing. Theory which suggests that potential should be aligned with entrepreneurs and ideas to solve problems and create jobs. And potential in economic terms is defined as capital. So money represents the potential to do something. A group of human beings represents the potential to collaborate and do something. So I define capital as the total potentiality of all human beings on the earth plus all the financial assets in the world. The issue with Wall Street became and is that while there's a thin veil of icing that is the stock market and the commodity markets and all the CEOs you see on CNBC and all the people that I used to talk about and do, there is an unseen underbelly, if you will, to our economy that is not talked about in financial journalism, that is not good ratings on CNBC, quite candidly, which is what we call the debt or the credit markets, which is the opposite of capitalism. It's basically inventing money by putting it on a computer and suggesting that the more of it you create, the more wealthy you are. And when it was revealed that was what the system was, Brian, in 2008, it was apparent to me that obviously we would restructure the banks and actually do this. And when the policy decision was made to instead deny everything that I just described to you as a matter of fact, but instead cover it up by virtue of simply printing money at the Federal Reserve, I quite candidly felt that it was impossible for me to continue in my former career.
You make a distinction in the book between capitalists and what you call extractionists. Is that related to what you were just saying?
Wall Street is a machine of extraction. Capitalism is simple. I actually live just half a block from 388 Greenwich Street, which is one of Citigroup's major headquarters, and I watch everybody commuting out of the building. And I look at the building. I have a puppy here in New York that I'm training, so I do a lot of picking up of poop in front of the Citigroup building in the evenings. And I look at that building. And what I realize when I see that building is what that building is doing is manufacturing risk. They're actually saying, listen, we will accumulate risk. And the nothing wrong with that. But the person accumulating risk, if Citigroup wants to decide to lend somebody $10 billion, well, then somebody in the building has to decide that they're able to carry that. But what's going on is that building is not manufacturing risk so much as it is a risk export business, where they manufacture risk, and instead of managing and investing it, they export it to the American currency and the American taxpayer as a business. People go into the building to say, how do we get the risk out of this building, and how do we swap it in the credit default swap market to someone else?
But did they also have to be stupid in addition to greedy along the way there? Because, yes, the banks were greedy by giving what they knew were bad mortgage loans because they knew they could export the risk into these bundled securities.
Well,
right?
Those securities were, and then ultimately to us. Securities were the transfer vehicle to us from them.
Well, I guess that's where the narrative usually stops. It was transferred into these securities. But someone, allegedly smart people at Goldman and Lehman and wherever, were betting on these mortgages. In other words, betting that enough of them would be repaid that the securities would make them money. Mm-hmm. No?
Yes. Well, at the same time, the securities were not necessarily didn't need to make them money by changing in value. In other words, it was the incentive was to manufacture debt, not to manage debt. What you're suggesting is they thought they were going to make money managing debt. Mm-hmm. That's not correct. What they were doing was looking to manufacture debt and then export it. And the people who got it, think of it like a game of hot potato. And what was really invented in the Rubin era as an economic model for the world.
Robert Rubin, the former Clinton Treasury Secretary.
And former CEO of Goldman Sachs. Robert Rubin created what was a brilliant concept in principle in the use of technology, which was we can export risk to the people that can most afford to bear that risk now using computers. I remember it's a great idea, by the way, in a room. Here's where they screwed it up, as far as I'm concerned, and it's why I wrote the book. They didn't distribute risk so that your risk, Brian Lehrer, here in New York, is more internalized to you and associated with your community. They lifted like a sponge all the tiny pieces of risk from all the people of the world and what terrible things might befall them or who might not be able to pay their bills. And they bundled it, picture like distributed water molecules that are floating around in the atmosphere like little risk molecules. And then imagine creating a machine that could suck all of them into a carbon. You know, carbon compresses to a diamond. And they basically took it and made a little spinning ball that suddenly nobody – so it appeared that there was no risk anywhere, but at the same time there was this kryptonite, which is literally $30-$50 trillion worth of catastrophic risk that only the government can bear and still is.
Dylan Radigan, MSNBC host, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Greedy Bastards: How We Can Stop Corporate Communists, Banksters, and Other Vampires from Sucking America Dry. Dylan Radigan fans, detractors, anyone else, 212-433-WNYC. You don't take calls on the MSNBC show.
I know. Right? I wish I did. I'm very excited for this, actually. I love it.
So we've got about 10 minutes for calls for Dylan Radigan, 212-433-WNYC. Call in right now. You'll get right on, 212-433-9692. All our lines but one are open. I want to make sure to get to one other thing. I could talk all day about how we got to 2008, but I'm not sure everybody wants to.
I doubt it.
You are leading a charge for a constitutional amendment as your core proposal.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
After the experience that we just described at CNBC and the sort of revelation and the sort of end of my naivete, if you will, it became apparent that direct political engagement was the only path forward. And what I realized over the past 3 years of the financial reform and the healthcare reform and all this was that having watched $600 million come in from the banks and all of a sudden they don't reform the swaps market and they don't break up too big to fail, watching $600 million come into healthcare and all of a sudden they preserve the insurance monopoly, they preserve the pharmaceuticals monopoly, they don't create a public option or real competition in healthcare, it became apparent to me that arguing about policy was like barking at a wall because of the use of money to prevent actual change, which then led me to write this book to illustrate how money in every industry is doing the same thing to preserve itself, which leaves us quite candidly with no choice but to summon our own fortitude and individual decision as 311 million Americans individually in our own municipalities and our own communities to declare this, which, by the way, New York City is the leader of. I need to make a point here because New York City is not only the fashion capital and the money capital and the cultural capital of the West. New York City is the standard bearer for fair and free elections in a democracy. It has the best public finance in America. It has is the second city in America after Los Angeles to pass a resolution saying corporations are not people. And it is the best teaching opportunity to understand why simply overturning Citizens United is an inadequate response to the problem by virtue of the fact that Mike Bloomberg was able to. And I'm a big fan of Mr. Bloomberg's, and I also have some significant criticisms for him relative specifically to his relationship with the banking sector. But set anybody's opinion of him aside, a billionaire's ability to bypass the single best public finance apparatus in America in the most powerful, most prominent city in the West that is the leader of culture and aspiration is a direct indication that if we're going to do a constitutional amendment, we must go beyond Citizens United to deal with the 1977 decision of Buckley Vallejo, which declared that money was speech. Because if you're simply in favor of overturning Citizens United, what you are saying is the following. I don't want corporations to spend money in political elections, but I'm in favor of nonprofits from the Koch brothers to the NRA to the Sierra Club to the unions and individual billionaires controlling the financing of elections. That is the so you, if you want to go against Citizens United, what you are saying is I'm in favor of nonprofits
and
billionaires.
Your amendment would overturn both Citizens United and 1976 Buckley Vallejo.
Bingo.
To say that we can place actual limits on the amount that can actually be spent in a political
campaign. By anybody. Nonprofit, for-profit, rich guy. I don't care who you are. The suggestion that any special interest, whether it's an individual with wealth, whether it's an accumulated nonprofit like the Koch brothers, the NRA, or the unions, or whether it's a for-profit business like an oil company, any of those institutions or individuals driving money to our politicians are the best possible leverage to prevent change, Brian.
Paul in Newton, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hey, Paul, you're on with Dylan Radigan.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I 100% agree with the fact that the lobbying and the political change must change, you know, must be the way to go. How do you see this all playing out? I mean, in the past, it's happened before. You know, it seems like the powers to be throw the public a bone, and it seems like it diffuses everyone's issues, and we're back to square
right.
one.
How do we ever get there politically?
Yeah. So politically, here's what I would suggest. You have to have the awareness that the level of pain and suffering as a result of record poverty in this country, highest unemployment since the Depression in this country, and an inside-out housing market has created a remarkable incentive for people that may otherwise remain complacent to act. The question is, what will they do? And so what I am suggesting from a political strategy is the following. A winter of consensus among those who would look to form an amendment to understand if you just want to do Citizens United, go in with your eyes open. I'm not going to tell you not to do it. Who am I? I'm one of 311 million people. But if you're going to do it, know what you're doing to what we just said. Once you make it through the winter of consensus and have a language of some kind that can address this, what we need in 2012 is to use the toxicity of the 2012 election to create municipal organizations all over the country to pass resolutions modeled after New York and Los Angeles that will allow people to find one another to create communities of shared belief and shared interests in 2012 using the toxicity of this current election as a recruiting vehicle mm-hmm. for those municipal resolutions. Successfully accomplishing the municipal development of those resolutions and communities in 2012, we can do states in 2013, build those states from the municipalities, and I believe deliver a coup de grace with the amendment in 2014 with
really?
A national strategy modeled after the movement of the amendment to 18, not after the ERA, meaning a justice narrative. It is unjust for all 311 million Americans to be treated in a rigged system as opposed to a lefty-righty narrative, which is what happened to the ERA, and it was marginalized. So if you're looking to learn something about this amendment, look to how the people of this country, our brothers and sisters in this country, our countrymen, passed the last amendment to move the voting age to 18. That is our model.
Mark in Summit. You're on WNYC with Dylan Radigan. Hello.
Hey, Dylan. How are you?
I'm great.
I love your show on MSNBC.
And nice to talk to you.
So here's my question, and it ties into what's going on right now with Mitt Romney and Bain Capital and all the controversial issues about that. So Bain Capital and the private equity firms, aren't they really kind of extractionists too, as well as capitalists? Because when they go in to buy up a company that they probably know is going to fail anyway, don't they buy it up and extract all the fees and take advantage of all the tax loopholes to make money and then just let it fail anyway because they knew from the outset that there was no saving it?
Mark, thank you. This is the obsession du jour. Where do you come down?
It is actually worse than you described. Mitt Romney, as an individual, I can't speak to him. I don't think it's appropriate. I've not spent enough time with him. The private equity business, which he participated in, was a leader in, was one of the and is one of the principal and most expert practitioners of extractionism on the planet Earth. It is not simply that they purchase a business or invest in a business not with an eye towards developing or renovating it. Listen, the need to invest in outdated businesses and update them is a real thing, and we need to incentivize capitalists to invest the money to make those conversions. But unfortunately, it's much easier to take a business in need of a renovation or an updating and just disassemble it and take the money out. What is not discussed is this. If you have to invest your own money in a business to renovate it, you have a much higher threshold to determine whether you feel like it's worth the time and effort. If you can borrow other people's money, OPM is what they call it in the LBO business, you never want to use your own money. And why don't you want to use your own money? You don't want to use your own money because that would incentivize you to be aligned with the interest of the people in that business to fix it. If you're using other people's money, you will have completely misaligned interests, and you are now extracting the value from that business by disassembling it and using other people's money to fund it so you can pay yourself a dividend, which is the antithesis of capitalism by a mathematical definition, because it is only capitalism that has the aligned interests of the entrepreneur and the investor.
We have a minute left. President Obama will be talking in a few minutes about cutting the federal workforce today. It's not just Bain going in and laying off workers. It's President Obama talking about it today. Listeners, we will stream the president's remarks live on that, scheduled for about a half hour from now, 11:30-ish, on our politics website. It's itsafreecountry.org. Do you consider Obama, and we just have 15 seconds for an answer,
okay,
part of the problem, because he had the chance to participate in the public matching fund, limit your campaign spending, voluntary system in 2008. But when he saw he was raising a lot more money than anyone else, he backed out of it.
Everybody loves an auction when you're winning. Unfortunately, from my point of view, whoever is the president of the United States, regardless of his identity, is the single most responsible person for this problem in America. It is what the president is expected to do, which is to address the most critical issues in America. And I believe this is it.
Dylan Radigan, MSNBC host on 4 o'clock Monday through Friday. His new book is called Greedy Bastards, and I hope we can speak again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.